Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 31 years ago, psychotherapist Susie Orbach wrote the book, Fat is a Feminist Issue, and got the conversation started on women and negative body image. In a new book, she tells us what's happened with bodies and body image since then. It's not good news. Our bodies once worked for us. Now, she says, we work for them in an endless, grim slog for perfection. She sees a world now enslaved to impossible body images, ensnared in body hatred for women and men, even children. This hour on Point, Susie Orbach on our minds and bodies. You can join the conversation. Are you at war with your own body, at peace with it? And if there's body hatred out there, who or what's to blame? Hollywood, Botox, diet ads, the biggest loser? Joining me now from London is British psychotherapist and author Susie Orbach. She's known in the UK as the therapist who treated Princess Diana in her battle with bulimia. Orbach has for years been a leading thinker on eating disorders, gender, and body image. Her new book is Bodies. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Susie Orbach, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, and hello.
Hello. Our bodies should be a source of pleasure, I would think, but you write this.
If only.
You say they're becoming sites of serious suffering and disorder. What?
Yes.
Why?
For girls, for boys, for men, for women, from six to the old age home. I mean, not only, but very largely, a lot of people's experience is that their body is something they have to be worrying about and fretting about and thinking about and noticing all the time, rather than a place to live from that they can just enjoy and decorate in a pleasurable way, decorate and move in a pleasurable way.
So what's the evolution of our relationship with our bodies that you see? I mean, surely humans have always... vanity's not new.
No, vanity's not new, and I don't think we're talking about vanity. I wish it were just an issue of vanity, because I don't think girls who are over the toilet bowl in early adolescence are...
By which you mean throwing up...
throwing up what they've just
getting
eaten.
Getting rid of lunch or dinner or whatever to be thin.
Exactly. Or are involved in vanity per se. I think what they've perceived is that the body, the way they look, is absolutely crucial to their existence, and that they need to find a way of creating a body for themselves that will pass, if you like. Just drop in, overhear any conversation. It doesn't actually have to just be pre-adolescent girls. It could be people in their 50s. There will be conversation turns to the need to restrict this, the need to look after that, the need to do this. There will be issues around anguish and transformational responses. So when you say who, what, why, is this an issue of vanity? I mean, I think what I'd want to say to you is that this isn't a conspiracy sitting outside, sitting there. A particular aesthetic develops at a particular moment in history.
Mm-hmm.
It gets reduplicated and reduplicated because we're now part of a global culture in which we have this enormously powerful player called visual culture.
Mm.
You know, we see far more than 5,000 ads a week of perfected bodies. All pretty much, if you morph all the female ones together, they would be pretty much the same, because they're all elongated in the same way and they're shaped in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And they insinuate themselves into our experience, causing us to feel that there is something amiss with our own bodies. And we begin to see our own bodies in a critical form. And then you have various industries who make a lot of money on that. And therefore, it's in their interest, if you like, even if they wouldn't consciously be doing this, to stoke up concern and body hatred while I suppose, purporting to address it. So number one would be the diet industry, and we can talk about that.
Yep.
Another one would be the farmers, the pharmaceutical industry. Another would be the cosmetic surgery industry. Another one would be the food industry. I mean, these are all enormous industries that in part depend upon body dissatisfaction and disturbed eating for their profit-making capacities.
Susie Orbach, I wish you'd tell us more about what you've heard. You've had people on the couch for decades now. Mm. You've been very
yes.
public. I mean, you're one of the best-known, maybe the best-known psychotherapist in the U.K. Famous, though you don't, maybe can't talk about it, but famous for treating Princess Diana for bulimia. When you have folks on the couch, we don't have to name names here, but the kind of stories they're telling you, all the way back in the 70s, it's not as though you weren't hearing about this kind of issue.
Well, I think the thing that's so different now is that I've always been a general psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've written as many books about men and women psychology and relationships and what happens mm-hmm. as I have about the body. But what's been really interesting in the last few years, and very, very disturbing to me, is that people may come in with a relationship breakup or worries about their job or their parents. It doesn't really matter what the problem or the conflict is. And they will, en passant, say to you, expecting your assent, that they need to be doing something about their body, as though that has become a kind of accompanying mantra and an accompanying solution for all sorts of other difficulties. So they may not be coming in with a body difficulty,
right.
but it is just it's part of the compost, if you like, of their daily experience. Now, in the current economic crisis, the worst situation I've heard is people being scared of losing their jobs because they might be caught in the fridge all day long and not
caught
really knowing
in
what...
in the fridge. Oh, I see. If they were home not working, they'd just be grabbing one snack after another, and that's the worst nightmare.
Yeah, so that's pretty upsetting, right? I hear girls of 9, 10, 11 already discussing the kind of breasts they want to have and the kind of worries about their stomachs, right? I hear older women who are appalled at the fact that they find themselves caught up in fantasizing body transformations because that's just what you're meant to do, even though their life circumstances and their distress doesn't actually have to do with that. So what I hear
And they
on
must
the
be
couch,
embarrassed about that at a certain age to still be thinking about, oh my, I wish I looked like Barbie.
Well, I think that's – I don't think they quite look like Barbie, but I was in New York last week, and I definitely got the feeling that there was something illegal about being as old as I am. And
you mean know, everyone's nipped
that
and tucked and plumped.
Age was definitely a disease entity rather than neutral or – you know, and revered as it might have been two
generations ago. More in New York than London, Susie?
Yes, definitely. Mm. Definitely. In fact, when I did a piece for the New York Times magazine with one of your journalists there, she asked me my age and said, oh gosh, nobody will ever say their age because it is too embarrassing. And I thought that was a really interesting tip-off. So I don't think that is quite the same as in London. But I wouldn't say London has escaped this, and I don't think internationally we've escaped this because despite there being a grey pound or a grey dollar, that was before the economic crisis hit, or a grey euro, everything is focused on a notion of youth. And I think some of your rather more famous presenters and comedians in your country don't have faces that bear very much relationship to their ages. Am I correct?
So,
I mean, I just read
Botox
on the plane the Joan Rivers book.
Oh, well,
not just Botox. Botox would be kind of like... what can I say? That would be like moisturizer
minimally
compared
invasive.
To some of the...
right. No, we've got full lift, I mean, from the toes to the hairline, I suppose, and probably beyond then. You go so deep here. You describe our bodies somehow as having become, and this is a weird duality. Well, maybe it's always been part of it, the human condition, but our bodies as having become our enemies.
Well, what I was trying to discuss, and this is because I'm a psychoanalyst and I wanted to try and find a way of talking about what I see as the crisis in our bodies, is that I think a psychoanalyst and a psychologist, and so everybody now would accept, at least in North America, because in this sense you're very much more advanced, that our mental health is something or our psyche develops from our relationships. And we don't come fully grown with the psyche. It happens because of our personal and familial and interpersonal history and what happens with us and our siblings and our teachers, etc., etc., right? But we don't have that view of the body. We have a view of the body as being, if you like, naturalistic, and our DNA just unfolding with a kind of its own imprinted story.
And we would just receive it and live with it.
We receive it and live with it. And now, because modernity allows us to do all these wonderful things, we can transform it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the argument in this book is there never has been such a thing as a naturalized body or a natural body. A body only exists in culture. It only unfolds in relation to the particular local culture it grows up in. I mean, a Chinese baby raised in Boston or Phoenix or London is going to, by a white family, is going to gesticulate and move and have the jaw structure and everything that goes along with being a westernized child. It's not going to move or have the gait of a Chinese child.
Or the weight, right? Maybe.
Or also the weight. And what I was looking at in this book was how do we actually acquire an embodied self? How do we get the thing that we call a body? And what is happening to bodies in our time, that there is an instability in the origins of our bodies? We're quite used to having the idea of kind of a neurotic psychology, but we're not really used to a neurotic body, if I could put it in that way. And that's what I've been trying to talk about in this book.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about our mixed up, crazy, extreme attitudes toward our own bodies today. Body perfection, body hatred. My guest with us from London is Susie Orbach, psychotherapist. She's written, well, for decades now about all kinds of issues, but body image, not least in her new book, Bodies, really pushes the horizon of our understanding on out there. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's listen to just a couple of things in the culture sphere out there. Here's contestant Mandy Kramer, dropped 66 pounds on the NBC reality show The Biggest Loser. She says she's not done yet.
When I arrived at this ranch, I weighed 263 pounds. Now I weigh 197. America, next time you see me, I am not going to let you down. I am going to be in that size 2 dress at the finale if it kills me.
If it kills me. And it's not just real loss. It's what goes on, Susie Orbach points out, and others do too, with Photoshop and computer images, images that are of bodies that are really impossible, magazines filled with perfect smiles and pecs and hair. Are they real or Photoshop? In this New York Times web video, here's a confession from a photo retoucher.
Every picture has been worked on some 20, 30 rounds of going back and forth between the retouchers and the client and the agency. They are perfected to death. Just look, you know, you should just look through the magazines and just and consider it. And all that is there to alter your mind, alter your conception of what physical beauty is and what the possibility of attaining it is and what the means of attaining it are.
Susie Orbach, as if you needed proof, there it is. Here's the retoucher, 20 or 30 rounds to make those images super perfect, godlike.
Absolutely. And I mean, what's more disturbing to me is that you get retouching now of baby photos, so that there isn't actually even a history of what you looked like. There are pictures. If you go onto the website any-body.org, you'll see we've got up on that website pictures of three-year-olds who either have a gap in their teeth put in or taken away, depending on, you know, and they're made cuter so they look like China dolls. So that it isn't just what's done to adults' eyes. It is also what adults then project onto their children in terms of what kind of body look they need to have in order to feel that they belong and that they can own their own children.
And that's imprinted on humans from the very earliest days of infancy, you say. And that was kind of, it's hard for me, not as a non-professional psychotherapist, to take on board how that would work. I mean, how do
infants... Well, are you a dad?
Yes, very much so.
Right. So you see, you know, you relate to your, you related to, presumably, to your babies.
Yes, very much so.
In ways that were entirely unconscious, right? Mm-hmm. That everything to do with the feeding, the holding, the cooing, the tone of voice. Now, for example, we know that we talk to baby girls at a higher pitch than we talk to baby boys. We know that we have more conversation with girls than we do with boys. We know that baby boys are held more than baby girls. We know that they're potty trained later than baby girls. We know that baby boys are fed more often.
Sure, but body image, how does a parent convey that?
Now, just think about that's all going on completely unconsciously. But at the same time, the mother or the particularly in the case of female-reared children, which still most children are. Mm. I mean, I know this is a progressive radio station, but even so, if you think of the mother's body as being under assault all of the time, then the body that she is bringing to very early child-rearing, just like the psychology she brings, is one of... in the case of her body, it's one of extreme importance. And if it is one that feels under assault, which most women do, and they're now told they need to get back their pre-pregnancy body after 6 weeks, mm-hmm. which is absolutely insane, there's a kind of anxiety right in there, both about her own body and the body she's bringing to the baby, but also about her baby's appetite and how to respond to it. So that instead of this being an embracing, relaxing,
at ease,
at ease situation, there is anxiety filtered into that very, very origins of that mother-baby relating all too often, we think. Well, so go on.
Well, when you say that this leads to an instability of body image, I'm not sure I know exactly what that
well,
means.
Well, let me put it this way. Let me try by analogy, because I think it might be easier. We do think of there being a critical time for learning language.
Yes.
Right. If you don't learn to speak and practice everything about your jaw movements and your tongue and your teeth, and you will not be able to speak. You cannot speak Chinese at 12 if you haven't spoken it before. You can speak it, but you won't hear it in that certain kind of way. Mm. But if you don't learn to speak at all, or you're not introduced to language, it's very, very hard to get solid language on board. I think there's probably a critical time for the sense of embodiment. Now, so you will either get a secure sense of embodiment, or you will get an insecure or unstable sense of embodiment. And that will be set, if you like, a bit like that's your baseline. So it's not that you don't get a sense of your body. It's just what kind of a sense do you get, just like you do with your psychology. So body instability, I'm seeing... And I'm looking at this with a group of researchers at the New School in New York. Mm. We think is, if we look at the mother-baby videos, we think it is possible to pick up this kind of instability, worry being transgenerationally offered or picked up between mothers and babies.
So the child never settles on a comfortable sense of embodiment. This is my body. I'm fine with it. Let's just live.
Yeah. And what does that mean? It makes them then vulnerable to the blandishments of the various, both the merchants of body insecurity, but also the search to get a body that feels stable and secure. I wouldn't want to suggest, and I'm not suggesting in the book Bodies, that anybody who's frantically running up and down stairs or doing marathons or having cosmetic surgery or dieting or fretting is being superficial. What I think they're trying to do is often get a body that can feel stable for them because their body doesn't feel as though it's reliable. They're on a search all the time. Mm-hmm. They have to kind of be reminded and touch it in one way or another. I mean, that's my theoretical stance, if that makes sense to you.
Yes. There was a time, you write, Susie, when our bodies were more directly related to the everyday activity of our lives, our work, our labor, you write. Mm. And even that connection kind of lost here. I grew up among people doing lots of physical labor in an agricultural setting, but their bodies were a direct outgrowth of what they were doing.
And their bodies looked like they did agricultural labor,
sure,
right?
They
now
did.
We go to the gym to reproduce that manualized labor, right? I mean, it's really quite interesting because if you're middle class, you work in front of screens, or lower middle class,
yeah,
you work in front of screens all day, you go to reproduce a form of masculinity that has a lot in common with industrial labor.
Maybe
or
that's understandable.
Agricultural labor.
Maybe we're not comfortable looking so little like our grandfathers and great grandfathers. Maybe it's
well,
an urge
maybe
to.
Maybe so, maybe not, right? I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, that's not something I explore here. I think it's. I think the preoccupation with the body for men has been fairly recent at this level because strength or girth or solidity or. There were a lot of different options allowed to men. And what I suppose I'm worrying about these days is the kind of monoculture or the homogeneity, the narrowing of body types and body diversity. And the very fact, as you say, or as you read about what I wrote, is that we have a post-industrial body, which we have to work on rather than using our body as an aspect of creating other things.
I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Susie Orbach's new book is Bodies, and there are a lot who would like to speak with you. Let's go to Fort Myers, Florida, and Linda. Linda, you're on the air with Susie Orbach in London.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Susie.
Hi.
Hi.
So, when I heard that this topic was coming on, I was just driving back from the gym, so I immediately phoned. And I'm a 58-year-old woman. I weigh 105 pounds. I'm 5'4", and I'm generally described as slim. I'm a very small build. But, you know, I'm at the gym. Yes, I'm there for health, but really I'm there to try and keep the belly fat away. And essentially all my life I've been about the same weight as an adult. But every day I'm thinking about, you know, will my jeans fit? Do I have a spare tire? And I want to look good. My girlfriends, the same age, my girlfriends tell me that they're trying to date, and they can't get dates unless they lose weight, that they're too heavy to get dates, that guys only like, you know, slim women.
Linda, so, is this a bad thing, or does it keep you young? Do you feel burdened by this or engaged with it? What?
I don't know that I'm burdened, but I'm certainly conscious of it all the day. And when over, you know, holiday periods, I gain a few pounds, and I immediately cut back on calories. Because it's all about calories as far as I'm concerned. So all my life I've been slim. People look at me and say she's slim. And I have this rage going on inside me about thinking that I want to stay slim. I mean, what's going on? Can this be overcome?
Susie?
Well, I suppose the issue is, can you ever enjoy the size you are? It sounds as though you're... Your dilemma is that you can't, that you're, or that it's very hard for you to accept it.
Well, it must be. It must be hard. Also, why am I, you know, why is it so much in my mind? It can't be from my mother. My mother was totally great with however she was all her life. And I had one of those experiences at 40. I looked in the mirror and looked at my body and said, oh, my God, it's my mother.
But that is what happens to us at 40, right? I think that is what's so bizarre about us as a culture. I mean, I don't, in fact, look like my mother because my mother at my age was really in a different generation. So I probably would look ludicrous to her if she was alive. But I don't, in fact, I have exactly the same body. That is true. I mean, I think I'm a half an inch taller and I'm not very tall. But
and you're 60. What are you famously?
I'm 62.
62,
so,
now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I don't dress the way a generation before did. But I think what's interesting is how do we define these ages in a way that doesn't diminish us, but actually allows us to take up the age of 40, the age of 58, the age of 62, with the kind of energy and vivacity and interest and curiosity that it seems to me it's quite possible to have nowadays.
But does Linda sound like a slave to global body image to you, or like a vivacious 58-year-old?
A little bit, I think so. I mean, I think what she sounds, slave I wouldn't say, because it's one thing to talk in terms of a culture, and it's another thing to talk in terms of an individual.
Yeah.
But I think what she's expressing is her frustration that this is a continual focus for her, and that she doesn't have peace in relation to this, and that she can't take for granted that if she eats a couple... if she eats a little bit more for a couple of days, that she's actually, you know, her body will just readjust immediately. Actually, if she didn't watch the calories a few days later, it would just, that's how bodies are designed. And that she feels that she must be watchful all the time, as though, again, it's not just illegal to be old, because I don't actually think 58 is old, but it's sort of illegal to have a stomach, as though that is a sign of sloth and a precursor to self-dislike. Now, I mean, I'm kind of interested in what her friends say, because is it really the case that the women don't think they have, that they can meet partners or lovers, or is it that what they project about themselves is that they aren't confident enough because somehow their confidence has been eroded by the whole pressure on age and size?
Linda's away, but we'll ask and see what others have to say on that front. Susie Orbach is with us from London. Her new book is Bodies. Let's go to Hava in New York City. Hava, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm so glad that you're addressing this topic because it's so important to men, women, and children in our society. And even as a feminist myself, I'm still struggling with it every day. Mm-hmm. I have to keep checking myself. And I work with teenage girls, so it's even more important that I keep a strong front about this topic. Mm-hmm. But when I work with them, I try to teach them not only to not hate their bodies from the outside, but also to learn how to connect with themselves from the inside so that they have a relationship with the inside of their bodies and they can actually use their body as a source of power in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Learning how to contain emotional confusion and pain and process mm-hmm. things inside of themselves so that their body can actually not only not be their enemy, but also be a friend to them.
Susie, what do you say to that, whether it's Princess Diana or the teenager next door?
I'm absolutely with her. I mean, my daughter's just come out of being a teenager, and I've spent many, 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 many hours with teenagers, worked with a lot of teenagers, produced a lot of material for teenagers, particularly for schools and for mothers and daughters to try and help their daughters appreciate their developing bodies rather than be frightened and fearful of them. And I completely agree with you. I think what girls are offered, and increasingly boys, is to transform the problems, the ordinary dilemmas of growing up into eating or body transformation problems, rather than understanding that conflict and conflicting emotions and indecision or passionate desire for things are just part of the, and disappointment and heartbreak and all of those things are part of what it means to be human. Instead, they're kind of offered this beguiling, captivating set of images as a way to solve all the problems of being human. So I'm delighted to hear that you're working with kids in schools.
You mean look perfect and you'll transcend all your other human problems?
Well, you'll be transcending being human, because I think it's really interesting that those people who are photoshopped, photoshopped is too sweet a word for what happens with the digital enhancement when it goes 20 rounds. Those women and men who are in those images do no longer recognize themselves. So they aren't in fact human. They are dehumanized, right? But they've become a surface. And it's very, very important that youngsters, as well as people who are older, don't mistake the surface for the struggle to be human, which is, I think, what we're all involved in, which isn't to say that beauty isn't important, because it's obviously become an incredibly important category of late, and it's been democratized, and we all think it's very important. But within the notion that it's important, what's tragic is that only 2% of women worldwide feel able to enter into that category and say they feel that, even though it's critical to them.
And are those 2% happy?
Well, those are 2% who feel okay about their beauty. I don't know if they're happy on other counts.
Yeah, the psychotherapist catches the big hole in that question. Hava in New York, thanks for calling. Susie Orbach in London, please stand by. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about our mixed up, crazy, extreme attitudes toward our bodies today. Body perfection, body hatred. My guest is Susie Orbach, psychotherapist, author of the new book, Bodies. She joins us from London. I don't know if they get it there, but here's a little bit from the FX television show, Nip Tuck. about two plastic surgeons that keep pushing the boundaries of our looks-obsessed culture. Here, it's collagen for babies. Susie Orbach mentioned this. In this scene, Dr. Christian Troy and his patient, Kimmy, a plastic surgery addict with whom he has a complicated personal history, consider injections for her infant daughter.
Let me be clear, Kimmy. I will never, ever do another surgery on you again.
I'm not the one who needs the touch-up.
She does.
Your granddaughter has just been signed to the hottest baby modeling agency in town. But in order to book the high-end campaigns, we're going to have to do something about her mouth.
Kimber, get out.
We have to do something about the baby's mouth. Oh, boy. Susie Orbach, I don't know if you follow American presidential politics or even the kind of celebrity...
Oh, certainly I do at okay. this particular moment in history.
Well, I mean, we're going even further to the kind of, you know, celebrity yak-yak around it. There's our very lean president now. And the first lady, Michelle Obama, with her sculpted arms, guns in American youth parlance, thunder and lightning. I heard them called after a few appearances she made recently where they looked very muscular and very evident. Do you see that as healthy, or do we have a first couple that are prisoners of body image issues?
Well, I think what's interesting about the first couple is that we have a chance to change something about visual culture, which is that, I mean, he is, you know, he does seem to have the body type of a Kenyan. I know he's very, very caught up
like
in sport. And they do seem to be a remarkably lovely looking couple. I mean, I'm kind of more interested in their politics, but great that they look so good. All right. But what I think is interesting is that they begin to break up this very white and very limited aesthetic that we've had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's important about them in terms of this discussion, is not so much whether her arms are toned, but whether what we can begin to hope for is much more diverse and varied images in an image-based culture, because we're not going to be able to do away with images, just like we're not going to be able to do away with beauty, right? But what we need is to honor mm-hmm. all of the different types of sizes, shapes, and beauties and ages that there are, so that people can find themselves in it, rather than the gap between how they find themselves and what is offered as a site of aspiration doesn't become a place of distress, psychopathology, and also of enormous profit for, as I said before, those breeders of body insecurity or the merchants of it.
That suggests that we're prisoners of an incredibly tight straitjacket. If Michelle and Barack Obama, President and First mm-hmm. Lady, are so different that from that ideal that they actually break the mold.
But they're black, for goodness sake.
Well, there's a color issue. African Americans break the mold,
right?
It just shows how tight, how narrow the image normally is if their lean bodies represent breaking it.
Well, I think it is very tight. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we wouldn't have seen the cosmetic companies and the beauty industry making money through skin lightening creams. I mean, they do make a lot of money through that, right?
Yeah.
They make
yeah.
a lot. So I think it is absolutely critical. And I think we might begin to see a lot more diversity. But if you just take any issue of Vogue or whatever mm-hmm. I don't know what the men's magazines are there, you will see reduplicated almost the same bodies with very, very little variation, right? The fact
sure.
that she was on the cover of Vogue is completely and utterly extraordinary, because you could name the one black British model who's always been on the cover, and that's it.
Right.
It's you know, there haven't been more than that. There's been two in the entire history.
We don't get a psychotherapist on this too often. Bring Freud in here, if you would, for a moment, how he played in, his thinking played in, and how that maybe is changing now.
Well, I think what was so wonderful about Freud is that he over 113 years ago,
yeah.
When he wrote Studies in Hysteria, he tried to link, and very successfully linked, troubles that were expressed in the body with thoughts in the mind. So he would be a physician who would engage with somebody who had, let's say, a paralyzed limb, or spoke in a foreign tongue, or couldn't sign their name,
mm-hmm.
and There was no organic, biological reason why they couldn't do it. And out of his attempt to understand what these, quote, hysterical paralyses were, he opened up the option of his patients talking, developed the idea of free association, which is the foundation of psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. and discovered that through slips of the tongue and through dreams and through various ways of coming to know themselves, people's symptoms became very clear, their physical symptoms became very clear and dissolved. Okay, that is the origins of psychoanalysis. So for Freud, the idea was that troubles in the mind create troubles in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think that was pretty good, and we all believed that for quite a long time, except that it kind of left out the troubles in the body that may come from origins of troubles in the body, which is really what I'm trying to address, is that we've always seen the body as a kind of bit player,
mm-hmm.
or and the main player is the mind. It's kind of mm-hmm. been a dumping ground for, or a rubbish bin, we would say in England, for the problems in the mind. And what I've been wanting to address is, no, the body isn't only a bit player. Maybe the body has its own developmental history, as we were talking about a few minutes mm-hmm. ago. Maybe the way the body is introduced to the person, their own experience of embodiment and what their body can be for them, and their curiosities and the range their body can have, or the variability or the rigidity that they need to bring towards their body, can itself impact on the mind, just as the mind can impact on the body. And that maybe we shouldn't, as shrinks, be taking body problems as a code for mental issues. Maybe we have to be taking them as very serious concerns that the body itself is trying to come to therapy to kind of talk about itself, if that makes sense.
Yes, the body very much on the couch, along with the psyche.
Well, I mean, I don't have them on the couch. I have them sitting on the couch, because I like to see bodies, because I think that's quite important. But yes, exactly. Yeah. The body is also the patient. I mean, the patient is also its body. If you think about a very simple example, somebody walks into the therapy room. Well, don't forget the therapy room. Be at a party.
Okay.
Somebody walks into your personal space,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you back up because you kind of, you felt invaded.
Okay.
No, it feels too close.
Okay.
And so then they walk closer into your space and then you back up again, right?
Yeah,
and then it happens a third time. And maybe you do a cha-cha, right? And
mm-hmm.
maybe it kind of, now, in therapy, one would examine that. What on earth is going on? Why is that person needing to feel, to move into another person's personal body space? Is it because they don't have a body boundary of their own and they're searching for one? Is it because they're wanting you to kind of put up your hands and say, stop, mm-hmm. you know, this is where you begin, this is where you end.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a therapist historically would have analyzed that in terms of they don't know where they begin, they don't know where they end, but they mm-hmm. wouldn't have thought about it in terms of their embodiment issues and their own safety within their body.
Embodiment issues. We're on new terrain, and it's good.
Well, okay. It's just another way of describing
it. It's good. Let's go to JR in Boston. JR, you're on the air with Susie Orbach.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was thinking, as I was listening to Susie speak a couple of moments ago,
mm-hmm.
about saying we need to accept people for their selves and not for their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And some place that I've had some experience with this is with groups of nudists. I think that they are so, as a whole, are very unconcerned with appearances and more concerned with who the person really is, which to our society is the people that don't have any experience with it. It's a crazy idea. But I've found that to be so one of the best things about it, really.
And body image sensitivity less among people who are absolutely stark naked, JR?
Yes. Believe it or not.
Wow.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I by chance, for several years, my family and I holidayed in a part of Austria where there's always an FKK beach, which is the nude beach in the mountains, right?
I didn't know about nude beaches in the mountains, but good, okay.
Well, okay, but on these gorgeous mountain lakes.
Oh, yes, of course, great.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely fascinated because for the first 10 minutes that you're at one of these,
mm-hmm.
if you're not accustomed to clothes being off around you, except perhaps at home, you are, at least I was, riveted, you know,
mm-hmm.
look at this and look
wow.
at this and look at this mm-hmm. and look at this. But what gets you very interested is the massive variety and difference in those bodies. And then after about kind of 10 or 15 minutes, the fact that there's a kind of a butt right in front of you or a penis to the left of you or breasts of this shape kind of isn't relevant. Mm-hmm. I mean,
you're beyond it.
It's not that you're without bodies, because I don't think that would be the case, because the idea of being in these mountain lakes and having the water on your body is just absolutely magnificent. So it's not that you're free of bodies, you're actually in your body. But I think the body preoccupation in those places is had a completely different order of business. So I think it's a wonderful thing, but I think it is quite risky for people who aren't used to it. And, you know, I found it quite uncomfortable at first, and then very engaging.
But you write that the body preoccupation is, in a way, being broadcast globally, even to those corners, which, heretofore may not have had it. You write, in fact, you say body hatred has become the West's hidden export. The West?
Yes. Yes. Well, who else would it be? I mean, we are the main driver, Tom, of most of the kind of cultural stories that exist in globalism. So, yes, not just the Western ideal of the body, as in, you know, what you should look like under the hijab, or how the fact that you should have that double eyelid if you're, you know, or you should have that skinny body, or you should have the height of a Westerner. But along with that is a deconstructing or an undermining of the body of that person in China or in Iran or Fiji or South Korea or Colombia or Brazil, right? I mean, take Brazil. I think it's a really interesting example there because they've always had a practice about the body beautiful there.
Sure.
But until recently, it was the tush that was prized, right?
Okay.
But it's become completely Disneyfied. So now the preoccupation is with the breast, as though what you have to do is, I mean, I'm talking about women's bodies, obviously. Mm-hmm. So that is to reject the body that was prized and to supplant it with a different idea, a Westernized idea of what is the right kind of body.
You write about an epidemic of bulimia in Fiji, as I recall, after television was introduced there.
Mm-hmm. Well, this isn't my work. It's Anne Becker's from Harvard, actually. So she's an anthropologist and a psychiatrist, and she went and interviewed the girls in Fiji and 3 years after television was introduced, and discovered that 11.9% of them were over the toilet bowl with bulimia. Now, lest we think that they felt themselves to be kind of passive or stupid or just slavish followers of TV programs like Friends. No, what they thought was, I'm being modern. I'm entering the modern world, and this is the way I can do it. So they did it with relish, right? And if you think about it from another turn of the I don't know, if you think of it slightly differently, it's kind of a bit like how girls' feet used to be bound. We, you know, those girls didn't think there was anything wrong with it when they were in China.
It was the way.
It was the way. But now girls are understanding that their modernity, instead of being bequeathed to them when they're infants from having their feet crushed, is, oh, I will crush the whole of my body now so that I can look like a modern princess.
Wow. Let's go to Elaine in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you know?
I am, I'm a dance professor at a university here. Mm-hmm. And certainly we in the dance community have been fighting our bodies for a long time. So it's certainly an issue for us. I wanted to throw that out there. I mean, we are trying to get better about it. You don't see scales being pulled out in dance studios as often as it was, which is a good thing. But I was just wondering what your guest, you know, what she knows about performing arts.
Our time is short, but Susie Orbach, here's even a dancer feeling like they are fighting with their bodies. Well, maybe that's their work to have a certain body, or not.
Yeah, but I think I've worked with quite a lot of people in dance and in drama schools who are very, very concerned about what's happening with their students and all sorts of things. And let's remember this, that the particular aesthetic that pertains to dancing now is really quite recent. Okay, I know I'm very, very old, but when I was a youngster, Galina Ulanova and the Bolshoi ballerinas were hardly tiny little things. They were not sylphs. Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we have had an increasingly tinier and tinier aesthetic. And I've had many patients who were recruited from dance schools in England and were then told that they were too large and they weighed so little to begin with. And thank God the tide is turning. But it is a real issue that we've developed a notion that only the lithest, most narrow of bodies can be picked up and twirled, and they can twirl themselves. And that simply isn't true. It's just a kind of – it's the present visual image that is doing that.
Susie, we've got half a minute here, literally. Mm-hmm. The body image will not go away. We're in the image era, right? The media era. So
we are in the image era, but that doesn't mean we can't have multiple images. That's what we need, right? Because if you think of – if you think of the Gap ads where they did age, right, or you think the Benetton ads where they did color, you think of the Dove ads where they did age, size, color, everything, we need a lot more of that. So, as I said before, girls and boys and women and men can find themselves in those images rather than feeling disenfranchised and disembodied and with all the consequences we know that happen.
Let's get all the types out there and celebrate. Susie Orbach's new book is Bodies. Susie, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Listeners, you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.